We'll move to our third case this morning, which is case number 113810.
Good morning. Amanda Penabad from the University of Chicago's Mandel Legal Aid Clinic, appearing under the supervision of Allison Siegler on behalf of the appellant, Luis Marin Castano. At the time of sentencing, Mr. Marin was a 56-year-old man who had lived and worked in the United States for 17 years without incident and who had a single prior felony conviction that was over 25 years old. At the sentencing, the judge committed two significant errors. First, the court committed procedural error when it failed to address and rule on Mr. Marin's two separate 3553A arguments in support of a below-guideline sentence. Second, the ultimate sentence of the court was substantively unreasonable. Turning first to the procedural errors, this court has explicitly stated that it reviews procedural errors under a non-deferential de novo standard of review. There is no presumption of reasonableness that attaches to a district court's sentencing procedures. Mr. Marin advanced two principal arguments in his sentencing memorandum. The sentencing judge did not fulfill his two-part obligation under this court's precedent and the Supreme Court's precedent. First, to specifically address each legal argument in a way that demonstrated meaningful consideration, and second, to explain its reasons for rejecting that argument. This standard is rooted in Gaul, which requires a sentencing judge to follow these same two steps. The judge must address the 3553A factors, and it must adequately explain the sentence. The sentencing judge erred by entirely failing to address Mr. Marin's first principal argument, which was that a criminal history category 3 along the horizontal axis of the sentencing table overstated the need to protect the public from any future crimes under 3553A-2C.
If I could kind of cut to the chase here, both of the arguments about procedural error and much of the argument about substantive unreasonableness relate to the age of the defendant's prior conviction, as
yes,
I understand it. And the judge, Judge Dara, in this case, did, in fact, note that argument. He didn't specifically link it to particular 3553A factors, but he did take note of the argument that was being made about the age of the predicate conviction and the fact that a lot of time had passed and that he had been clean during much of that time or most of that time. So it's hardly a case where the judge didn't take note of the primary argument that was being made. It's just perhaps a failure to tie it up specifically to particular prongs in the legal analysis, and we've never said that that's required.
Your Honor, he did recite those facts, but this court does require more than that. And I think that Robertson is instructive on that point. In Robertson, the sentencing court mentioned that the defendant hadn't committed any crimes since 2002. But because the court failed to engage in the legal merit of the argument that the defendant had put forward, which was his evidence of rehabilitation, this court stated that under Robertson, what the district court should have done was addressed the defendant's criminal history and whether or not it reflected the risk of recidivism given the rehabilitation. Also, Miranda is instructive on this point. The judge did acknowledge the defendant's mental illness, but what he failed to do, and what this court specifically stated he failed to do, was tie that to the individual 3553A factors that the defendant had put forward. He advanced just punishment arguments. He advanced an incapacitation argument. He advanced a recidivism argument. And the court specifically said that the judge had to engage each of these arguments in order to have made a procedurally reasonable argument.
Well, you know, it seems to me that you're asserting that these are really two separate arguments that were being made, but they seem to be just different sides of the same coin, that you're going at the same point, or he was going at the same point, two different ways. But they really involve the same fundamental principles.
They involve the same underlying fact. They function on...
So we haven't said that a judge has to tick down each of the 3553A factors.
No, it's not necessary to tick down each of the factors. However, this court has stated that where a defendant advances a principal argument, the court must address that. That's under Cunningham. A judge that fails to recognize to address a argument that is of a recognized ground of legal merit and is tied to particular facts has committed an oversight.
True. But if really the there's a single principal argument and it is addressed in some way, isn't that so?
There can be more than one principal argument.
True.
There were more in Miranda.
True, but what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing out of this is really there is a single principal argument said a couple of different ways.
They're both rest on the same fact, Your Honor. However, the protection of the public argument functions along the horizontal axis of the sentencing table, and it changes his criminal history, whereas the seriousness of the offense functions along the vertical.
That's where they fit in the guideline scheme. That's true,
sure.
But the concepts and the concerns really revolve around a single principle.
Right. The judge was required to specifically address why the age of the previous conviction did not, and the intervening good behavior did not demonstrate that Mr. Marin was a reduced risk of recidivism. And related to the same fact, he was required to address why the age of the previous conviction and the intervening good behavior did not reflect a reduced seriousness of the offense. So even though it was the same fact, he was required to address the two different legal arguments. Regarding the protection of the public argument, I'd like to reiterate that the judge never mentioned the argument in his summary of the defense counsel's arguments, and he never addressed it in his ruling. The defense counsel had clearly laid this out in her sentencing memorandum, stating that classification 3 overstates the seriousness of Mr. Marin's criminal history as well as the need for a longer sentence in order to protect the public. And this court has held that a sentencing judge commits procedural error if he fails to mention a ground of recognized legal merit that rests on a factual basis.
The judge recited in summary fashion all the arguments that were made in the sentencing memoranda of each side and invited counsel to say whether anything had been overlooked. That's
mm-hmm.
This judge's practice, apparently, is to start the hearing in that fashion,
sure.
Which is not uncommon and generally good practice. And the defense attorney said, no, I don't have anything to add. You've summarized it just fine and moved on.
Well, Your Honor, the defense attorney made this argument on page 7 and 8 of her sentencing memorandum, pages 7 and 8 of the appendix. And she also reiterated this argument during the hearing, and you can find that on pages 17 and 18 of the appendix. She said, if we could erase the drug trafficking conviction, the 27-year-old drug trafficking conviction, it would have had an astounding impact on the guideline range. We would lose 5 points for criminal history, so he would have a criminal history category of 1. So even though she did not respond at that juncture on appendix page 14, lines 15 through 18, she did come back and make that argument. And the judge never addressed it. The judge never mentioned protection of the public. He never mentioned how those 17 years reflected on Mr. Marin's risk of recidivism. This is a different man. The Supreme Court has said that recently in Pepper that the court must address the defendant as he stands before the court on the day of sentencing. There's no evidence.
You're in your rebuttal, you know. You're in your rebuttal time.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. If there's no questions at this time, I'll save the rest of the time for my rebuttal.
That's fine, of course.
May it please the Court, Michelle Peterson appearing on behalf of the United States. In this case, the district court properly considered arguments advanced by the defendant in mitigation at sentencing before arriving at a low end of the guideline sentence. And we know that because the district court explicitly states so. The first argument raised by the defendant is that a within guideline sentence is greater than necessary to protect the public from future crimes. When explaining the sentence, the district court explicitly states that he was taking into account the age of the prior drug conviction, the fact that the defendant had lived in this country for 18 or 19 years without legal entanglements, the fact that the defendant had been employed while he was in the United States, and the fact that the defendant has a lack of many ties to the United States. However, the sentencing court did not find these arguments to be persuasive because the district court was concerned that the defendant would illegally re-enter in the future. In fact, the sentencing court states that as to specific deterrence, the defendant's prior contacts with law enforcement did not deter him, and that jail would, you know, at least keep him from re-entering illegally while he was in jail. The district court is obviously concerned that the defendant will re-enter the country illegally in the future. And part of protecting the public from future crimes is to protect the public from future crime of illegal re-entry. So the district court simply is not persuaded by the defendant's argument that he's not going to re-offend in the future. The second argument that the district court weighs is that a within-guideline sentence would be greater than necessary given the seriousness of the offense. And in this case, the district court first makes some general comments about how illegal reentry is a serious offense generally because the country has a need to protect its borders. But then it talks about the defendant specifically, and the court says, you know, specifically, this defendant reentered the country very close in time to his prior conviction. And not only that, but he was on parole. So when he reentered the country, it was both in violation of his parole and in violation of his deportation order. And that's what makes this crime particularly a serious one. So the district court explicitly states on more than one occasion that the prior drug conviction is old and that it happened a very long time ago, and it acknowledges that the defendant is making an argument about the age of the offense, but it simply does not persuade the court that this is not a serious offense. Additionally, the district court arrives at a sentence that is substantively reasonable. This court, under an abuse of discretion, gives deference to a within-guideline sentence, and this sentence is at the very lowest end of the guidelines. Now, in their briefs, the defendant talks a lot about an Amezcua-Vasquez case from the Ninth Circuit. But this case is distinguishable from Amezcua-Vasquez both factually and legally. First of all, most important, it's distinguishable factually. In the Amezcua-Vasquez case, the defendant committed a violent crime in 1981, but he was not deported until 2006. So that defendant was living legally in the country during that entire time period, returns to the country close in time to his deportation, but not close in time to his prior conviction. And that's different than in this case. In this case, the defendant returns to the country within 3 years of being released from his prior drug conviction, and he resides in the country illegally for over 20 years. So factually, that's very different. And in fact, the Ninth Circuit says Amezcua-Vasquez is limited to its facts, and that if the defendant had returned closer in time to those prior convictions, the sentence might not be unreasonable, as the Ninth Circuit found that it was. So this case is distinguishable factually from Amezcua-Vasquez. Not only that, but Amezcua-Vasquez, the difference is that the Ninth Circuit does not have a presumption of reasonableness to a within-guideline sentence, and this circuit does. So legally, there is also a difference between that case and this case. This circuit has not reviewed Amezcua-Vasquez, but the Fifth Circuit has, and has twice found that a relatively stale conviction, 15 or 21 years old, a within-guidelines sentence that includes the 16-level enhancement that's at issue in this case, is still reasonable. And the staleness of those convictions does not overcome the presumption of reasonableness.
Well, and we would get into a serious line-drawing problem for sentencing purposes if we adopted some sort of a staleness of the conviction presumption or some such. How do you decide what's too stale and so forth? I mean, these are highly discretionary matters for the district court to take into consideration, it seems to me. So any bright-line rules stemming from the Ninth Circuit's case or any place else would be a problem.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the Ninth Circuit is careful to say we're just looking at the facts of this case, and the facts of this particular case are different. Seeing no further questions, we would ask for the sentence to be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Penabad, anything further? You have a minute.
Your Honor, I'd like to respond to a couple of the points the government raised. The government argued that the district court did, in fact, consider that the district court was concerned with the possibility of reenter. reentry. However, that's nowhere in the record. He never stated that he was specifically concerned about reentry. He did make a general statement about deterrence, which the government quoted, the fact that the defendant would be deterred while incarcerated. However, that's a generalized statement. And under Miranda, this court rejected that same statement. Every defendant is deterred while he's incarcerated. This is not a specific finding about Mr. Marin. There was no statement about what Mr. Marin's specific recidivism risk was, given the fact that his conviction was so old and that he had all this good behavior intervening. Second, the government spoke about the seriousness of the offense and that there was a discussion about that seriousness. However, when the district court spoke about the seriousness of the offense, again, he made generalized statements about that did not consider Mr. Marin, as he stood before the court on the day of sentencing in 2011, with that good behavior behind him, as required by the Supreme Court in Pepper. For these reasons, we ask that this court vacate the sentence below and remand for resentencing.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel and Ms. Penabad and the Law School Clinic. Our thanks to you as well for your able representation of your client. The court appreciates your work. And thanks to the government as well. The case is taken under advisement.